Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, veterans of all nations, to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, summer has started, and a lot of activities are happening. Here in East Central Illinois, the Vietnam Moving Wall is now just arrived today at Mahomet and Lake of the Woods Park for Champaign County here in East Central Illinois. We're about two and a half hours south of Chicago, 2 hours west of Indianapolis, Indiana, and about 2 hours east of Springfield, Illinois, and about 2.5 hours northeast of St. Louis, Missouri. So anyhow, the Vietnam Movable Wall is at Lake of the Woods State Park in Mahomet, Illinois, for the next 4 days, and we're going to talk about it today. Hey, Bob, welcome. Ray, how are you?
Good, Doug. How about yourself?
Well, we've had a lot of storms here. I mean, anytime I see the wall, anytime I think about the wall, anytime I get a plan to go visit the wall, it brings back memories.
It certainly does.
An experience beyond anything imaginable in human endeavor, I think.
Well, I think so, too. It's almost like peeling the scars back or peeling the scabs back sometimes. And, you know, I wrote that book called The Never Ending War, and it's about it never really completely heals. It's there are life situations and world situations that seemingly always constantly keep it kind of ripped and hurting and painful. And you know, you talk about rain, but I've thought many times at funerals when it's raining or at the wall when it's raining, it's almost like God is crying. God is weeping for us. And there's always a perspective from that.
You know, when I was in Vietnam, there was a song that was famous, A Rainy Night in Georgia. And I remember that song, and so with the rainy time and the Vietnam Wall coming here, I mean, the memories just flood on back.
Yes.
And I'd come off of a mission, and we'd go to get something to eat before we went back to bed, and that'd be playing on the jukebox or whatever. And I guess it just, you know, someone's crying all over the world. You know, when we looked at the casualties of Vietnam, and you and I both lost too many friends over there, you specifically, the number that were killed in hostile action was 25,358 individuals in the United States Army, 1,115 in the United States Navy, 537 in the U.S. Air Force. That includes my friends. That's where they were at,
yeah,
most of them. And then your group, United States Marine Corps, was 11,491. And the Coast Guard, there were four. These are the ones killed in action, hostile fire, killed in action. And then we got another 5,000 that died of, you know, hostile died of wounds. And then another 3,000 that died while missing. Another 116 that died as prisoners of war. And then, as always, the DNBI deaths was 7,455. And then another 1,000 from illnesses, injuries, and then non-hostile died while missing was another 1,353. That's 58,178 of our generation.
That's true. And, you know, they had a song one time, a country song, actually, I think it was, but it was said, his name is more than, it's more than a name on the wall. Because every name represents a human being with a family and with love and with hopes and dreams. And when you lose him like that, you know, they say, well, he gave his life. No, he had his life taken from him, generally. And it grieves people, and it never goes away. Every time you see a name or see a friend or see him, it's always there. And so they call it forever young, where they never grow old.
I mean, we both lost friends when we were young, and they were very young. I mean, I'll never forget, I had come back. I got back in June of 1971 and started college in September of 71. You know, and I just 3 days after I got discharged. In other words, I wasn't a human being at all. I mean, I got discharged, hey, you're ready to go to school, and 3 days later I was at college. And at Christmas time in 72, I remember we were there, and at the school where my wife was teaching, a state police officer from the state of Illinois down in the area where my wife was teaching came up, and he was doing the, you know, Christmas safety lecture for everybody, you know, what they do at the schools. I mean, incredible guy. And as we got introduced to everybody, and I was introduced, and he looked at me and said, "Are you the flying squirrel?" And I looked at him, and I go, "How would you know that?" Wow. And then he told me that his brother, Larry Robert Lynn, had just been shot down over North Vietnam.
Wow.
You know, within the last week, and it was like, I thought we had escaped safely. I thought we had got out, and yet it sucked us back in, and now I found out another friend was dead. How did it feel with all your guys? You had a reunion, didn't you, at the wall?
Well, we did, and, you know, 30 years after Vietnam, because one of the things happened was the last time many of us saw each other was in a major battle, and my platoon took 78% casualties, I think it was. We started out with 48. We ended up with six of us, and everybody was dead or wounded. And when you're throwing them on choppers and everything is hectic and you're still in the battle, you don't know where the guy's wounded. All you know, he's covered in blood, he's angry, he's passed out, or he's dying or dead. You don't know what he is. And so we left him there. And for 30 years, we were, you know, I had a hole in my heart, in my life, of not knowing what happened, how it ended. And so through the Internet, when the Internet came about, and I talk about it in the book, about the Internet opened a whole new world, because you could actually contact the military, whatever branch you're in, and they would give you a roster for your company of any 2 months ended during the Vietnam War. And so I was able to locate certain names and serial numbers of guys and different things. And, you know, we call the guy Tex, or we call him Oki or something, but we weren't even sure what his name was sometime, but I was a squad leader, so I did know some names. And through that, I was able to contact people. One of the sad parts is I was going through the VA, some of this stuff, because a lot of these guys were wounded. And I sent a letter to them and asked them about trying to find somebody who was wounded that day. And they responded back to me that that guy had died like 2 days before he got the letter. I mean, 2 years before I sent the letter to him. I mean, he got wounded in 1969, and it was 1997 or 8 that the guy succumbed to his wounds he got from that ambush that day. So he had lived all those years, 28 years or so, maybe in a vegetative state, I don't know what he was, but he died 2 years before I was able to get up with the family. And I was able to locate about 10 of us through that process of trying to find him, and we had our first reunion at the Vietnam War in 2000, in the year 2000. It was incredible.
So now, when was it that the ridge took place, in 1969, what month?
It was September 15th, 1969. That was when we got wiped out. You know, several things happened. We got separated, and then the six that were still left, we got separated about a week and a half, 2 weeks later, because they sent us to other units. And so we lost contact with everybody. We had a lot of open-ended stories that had no end to it. And so the reunion that I put together in the year 2000 that brought 10 of us together, that's what I could find. It was called Reopening the Book and Closing or Ending the Story, I think it was. Finishing the story. And so what we did, we reopened the story of Aquilo Company, and we finished writing the end of it. Well, we came back together after all these years, and each one of us had a lot of information. We had answers to a lot of questions. And so collectively, we learned a lot of things, and guys would say, yeah, I was on the hospital ship with so-and-so and so-and-so, and they could tell you about some guy died, but you learn that a lot of them still alive. So through that, I began kept looking through the Internet and really relying on the Internet, and I found about 22 of us all together from the ambush and there, you know, in the life of Kilo Company right there. So we found our commanding officers. Doug, it was one thing we did at the reunion that helped us, because, and you said the same thing, it's almost like a never-ending story. We never get the closure that we'd love to have. Well, one thing I had these men to do was I had each one of them that came from Texas and California and Rhode Island and different places. I had each one of them to bring a little baggie of dirt from their homes. Now, we were never, I mean, we were torn apart, and we never had an end to anything. So at the Vietnam Memorial where we met and spent about 3 days together, you know, around D.C., but at the Vietnam Memorial, I had each one of them to give me that bag of dirt they brought with them, and we poured it all into one bag, and we sifted it all together, and then we took it up to the Vietnam Memorial, and we poured it out where the guys' names are on the wall, and we sifted it into the dirt around the wall, and it became pretty much of a memorial of Kilo Company coming back together. And it gave her a degree of closure that we wouldn't have had any other way. And little things like that help you to bring a little bit of closure, a little bit of peace. And so those things are good, the reunions and such. But they also reopen wounds, too, because you have to relive it all again.
You know, as we get the wounds that are reopened, I mean, you got the psychological wound and the moral injury wound, the wound of the deep soul, which is far greater than any physiological wound. But all of us are still dealing with our physiological injuries. And the frustration, as you know, you and I and all the rest of us, I mean, we've had an incredible difficult time trying to get the medical care we earn and serving our nation from the VA or from the military. I mean, they disavow we were there. They disavow that it happened. They decide for political reasons to cut back on your meds without providing you proper treatment. And it just continues. And so the pain within the heart and the soul gets reopened and reopened and reopened. But
it
at
is.
The same
and,
time, we
you know,
have to
I'm
have
working
to
with
move
people
on.
Today at Camp Lejeune and Cherry Point, different bases, Air Force bases, anywhere they allow me to go in. And I talk to these young men. Because we came back, Doug, and there wasn't a whole lot of resolve to it. We didn't have anyone to connect with. We were separated. Usually if you didn't get any names or phone numbers, because that's all we had back then, or the addresses, you were pretty much turned out on your own. And fortunately, you made some good choices. Some of us were wounded, and we made some bad choices, and we felt isolated. And what we do today is we try to go and find these young men in the military, young women, who have been to abandoned in so many ways, and they're dealing with the same emotional problems, only it's a different problem, but it's the same problem of abandonment, of being wounded physically, emotionally, all these different ways. And instead of them doing what we did, we're trying to intervene and try to give them some hope and some help to not let them camp out on the beaches of life waiting for their ships to come in. They have to get their feet wet. They have to begin to move on, get goals and things. And so that's where you and I get a lot of benefits from helping these young warriors and their families, because their families suffer too. And
yeah,
are
the
suffering.
Families, we forget that. I mean, as I mentioned, I mean, I got a videotape series I've been watching called Army Wives, and it's the most incredible thing. I didn't know it was on TV. It was on cable, so we never got it because we only get antenna. But we've been watching it, and this thing has touched on all of the stuff, the betrayals, the isolation, the infighting, the bickering, the denials of care, the everything that you see within the entire military. And I think all of that keeps coming back and doing it, but at the same time, and this is what we've all tried to strive, and you and I both strive for, and I think hopefully we can get others to see it, is you make the conscious choice, because so many individuals, and we go back to antiquity, you know, with the military for sure, and the veterans that I've talked to in my life career, I met veterans from Spanish-American War forward, and then obviously our parents were, you know, our dads or uncles were in World War II. Or some of our cousins and, you know, other ones were in Korea, and then all of us went to Vietnam. And then some of those we served with, like my commanding general, Frank Elliott, who I met as a 19-year-old and knew him the rest of my life until he died. He served in World War II, he served in Korea, and he served in Vietnam, and he finally retired in the middle 70s, but after 30 years. But, you know, all those people... Over the lifespan and what we've seen and we keep hearing all and over again, so many Vietnam veterans came back broken.
Yes.
And they never came home. And then they made the conscious choice to get involved with alcohol or street drugs. And that's been said over and over and over again, and it's being emphasized again this movie, this series, television series, Army Wives. The marriage has collapsed. Whether the spouse couldn't deal with the injuries of the individual, they couldn't deal with the changes in lifestyle, they couldn't deal with the changes of responsibility.
That's right, yeah.
But you had an entire generation and multiple generation, and then that generation then impinged on the new next generation that became wounded and now went to war under the latest things, OIF and OEF and all this nonsense in the Balkans.
That's true. And, you know, being young like that, being immature, a lot of people, I never took it, but a lot of people took R&R while they were in Vietnam. And in that week of really government-funded party, what you did, a lot of these guys went to foreign countries or Australia, sometimes Hawaii, but other countries, Japan, different places. But some of these nations they went to were kind of wild and woolly, too. And these young men and women began their beginnings on drugs and alcohol and pornography and prostitution and a little bit of everything during that week. And it began to build. And so when they came home, they may have been mature in their thinking, and now they've had more to distract them from where they need to be in life. And a lot of them were distracted for a long time. And it took a toll on these young men and women. And you and I see men today, especially men, and it seemed as though they never moved on. They were never able to grasp it. And after you go so far, it's hard to get started because everybody's left you. You're the oldest guy in the class. It's just like, you don't want to be that, you know? And what are you doing here? And you should be somewhere in life. Well, I didn't get there. And so it caused a lot of problems for these young men who got stymied by being in the military. When you're in the military, they think for you. They clothe you, they feed you, they do everything for you. And it doesn't teach you a whole lot of responsibility. I mean, you're responsible for certain things, but as far as life itself. And so it was a hard lesson to learn. And I think it was one of the sacrifices these young men and women made when they went in the military. There's a scripture in the Bible in John that talks about no greater love than this, that a man would give his life for his friends or a woman. And when you go into the military, there's two ways to give your life. One way, well, actually three ways, really, is that you give your life physically for someone, or you give your life in the military because you give up on your freedoms and your life to be part of something bigger than you. And then later in life, you give up your life to help other people. I'm reading a book right now, Doug, that's called Man's Search for Meaning, and it's by Viktor Frankl. He was a survivor of Auschwitz in World War II, and he was in several prison camps. And he said he saw hundreds and thousands of people dying, and a lot of them died not from their injuries, but from lack of hope. They just gave up, laid down.
Frankl is right. I've also got the book, and we brought it up, and I was pulling my copy out, and then you said you had yours.
Right.
But Frankl said, as long as you have a purpose and a goal in life,
that's right,
you can endure almost anything. If you see a hope and a dream and see the next point that you're going to go to, then you can take that leap and more forward. When we got out and got back to school in September of 1971, and I was majoring in physics and math and pretty heavy-duty stuff, but 8 out of the 10 of us had graduated. My graduating class were all Vietnam vets.
Wow.
And we had an extraordinarily unique situation because the department head was an Army lieutenant colonel, okay, in the reserves. And it was such a unique experience because here we're come back to study in school. We're all right smack dab out. One of the guys had been a squad leader with Cali at My Lai. We've talked about that on this radio show. We've discussed it in depth, had the prosecutor on the radio show. But the whole way in life and dreams and everything had changed, and it was so easy, and we saw this. We had the temptation to fall into this trap where the alcohol and the drugs were available, and as you said, you choose the friends you're going to be around, and you make the choices of what you're going to do.
That's true.
Well, with the pain and the suffering and the physiological trauma and the psychological trauma, the inability to get medical care, the inability to understand what happened, the easiest choice is to drown yourself in the alcohol, the booze, or the street drugs.
It is, and a lot of people
fall to it.
It
ends up with nothing.
Well, Frankl said a man's inner strength may raise him above his outward fate. Forces beyond our control can take away everything you possess, except one thing, your freedom to choose how you would respond to the situation. Our response is the difference between life and death. It was and it is. And today it's the same thing for each one of us. We can choose to live, prosper, move on, help other people, do these things, or we can choose to just give up and let go, and we'll lose it all.
I think the wall is so many lost hopes and dreams because, you know, all the individuals that died up there, I mean, we have to come back for it, and I think this is the thing with the Vietnam Wall. For our fathers and older cousins, Vietnam, you know, I mean, it's a whole different thing than World War II. World War II had a very distinctive threat, had a very distinctive enemy, had a very clear morality issue of what we had to do and what we had to achieve.
Right.
We had the atrocities of the Nazis and the Holocaust, and we had all the atrocities of the Japanese. So it was very, very clear to everybody why they were doing it and what they're doing it. And yet in Vietnam, as we've all learned, and no matter whether we want to acknowledge it or not, we know today the Gulf of Tonkin incident never occurred. We know
sure.
We were led astray and led into a thing and thought to believe that all this stuff was going to happen for political and economic reasons and not to defend a nation that had a viable threat to suspend freedoms or the government or anything else. And so this quagmire that the Vietnam veteran got into, where he couldn't justify the tremendous losses as represented by the Vietnam Wall, the tremendous losses that each one of the Vietnam vet, male or female, experienced, they're sitting in their a limbo area. And that's what's happened in the recent wars. There's been no clear justification for them. I mean, we have to call it as it is. And so you're caught into a limbo land of how do I justify this incredible loss that I sustained, the incredible loss that I continue to sustain, and how do I move on?
Well, you know, you hit on something that's very hard to understand sometimes, but it also has a simple solution to it. Because we can't rationalize it, Doug. We can't fix it. You know, this man that wrote the foreword in the book, Harold Kushner, he said, forces beyond your control can take away everything from you except the one thing you have, and that is the freedom to make a choice. I'm not going to let it stop me from working. You cannot allow your past, as bad as it is, to control your future. Now, you've done very well with that, Doug, but we're talking to young men today who have that same choice that you made a long time ago. And it matters what direction they take on a fork in the road. Do you sit down and wait for the VA to help you? Do you sit down and wait and people will feel sorry for you and things? Or do you get up and begin moving in spite of your injuries? And so it's a process that we have to understand. And actually, your hard times can become a motivator to help you to move forward. We lost friends. But what greater honor would it be for us to give to our friends, but to live, help us to live a better life? That would be the greatest honor.
You know,
we do it for them, we do it for us, we do it for others. With the moral injury, we talk about that a lot. But the moral injury has to do with the conscience of man, the morality of man, the Ten Commandments, that all tie together. And there's only one person that can, anybody that can fix a moral injury, because you may not be able to go back and fix it. You might not go back and make people apologize, but you can go to God. God is a healer of the hearts. and he's a healer of the conscience. He actually takes, you know, it was like a child one time, I saw him with a piece of paper, and they were drawing a picture, and they messed it up. And they took it to the parrot, and they said, I messed it up. And the parrot crunched it up and threw it in a trash can and gave him a new sheet and said, try it over. That didn't get rid of the fact that he had messed up. But in spite of the mess up, he was able to move forward. And God is that. I said in my book, I said, God did not promise me a road that was without bumps. He just put a shocks on my wagon so it wouldn't hurt so bad. And I still get whacked. You get whacked. We get hit a lot of. But he takes a lot of the pain out of that and puts shocks on your wagon, as it were, and helps you through life, a comforter, a keeper. God is the one being that never left me. It seemed like everybody I loved left me somewhere in my life, but God was the only one that stayed with me. And he is the inner strength that helps me to face a lot of our problems. We must believe there is a point to our sufferings. Well, Doug, how do you use your sufferings for somebody else in the future? There's a point to that, you know, and they used to call it, I live in North Carolina down near the ocean, they call it salt treated. When you go buy lumber, you want salt treated because it lasts a long time. It can take a licking and keep on ticking kind of thing. And so a lot of hard places in our lives only toughen us up for the battles ahead. The battles will continue to come. But the difference is, we talked about this before, the difference is the difference between surviving and thriving. And we all have the choice of that. We can make a decision of saying, I'm tired of suffering. I'm tired of just simply surviving. I want to do something better. I want to thrive.
You know, the thriving thing we've all heard, and I've had this in more than one chaplain, and you as a retired chaplain have said this before, and we had this happen to myself Christmas in 1970. I've told the story where we bombed on Christmas morning, and we came back after going to Christmas services, and God forgave us.
Yeah.
And it's the whole thing is how do we forgive ourselves? I mean, God did forgive us.
That's right.
Because it was beyond our control, beyond our operation, beyond our imagination, beyond our comprehension and understanding. And so he's out there and reaches out and does forgive us, but then we have to forgive ourselves.
That's true.
And that's an internal free will choice, a choice of what you're going to do with your life and how do you move on. The fact that you can thrive. So when I looked at the 58,000 names on the wall, and you where I can't think much more, I mean, because your unit and your story, you know, for September 1969, when only 60 walked out, the loss there is beyond anything imaginable and comprehensible. And as Dr. Bob has said, and we'll continue the conversation next week, the brain of the young military soldier who is 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old has not fully developed, where their whole rational thought process is not there to understand and comprehend and make do. And that was a realization for me that was staggering, because it put everything into another perspective.
It does. When in the Air Force, when you have a maintenance that takes care of a single airplane. I know they did in World War II. I'm not sure how they do it. I wasn't in the Air Force. But when you have men working on aircraft and keeping that thing aloft and keeping it fighting in shape, and they lose that aircraft and the air crew with it, that's part of your family. That knocks the wind out of you. And you have to move on and go to somewhere else. But you will be grieving about that probably the rest of your life. The grieving process, we can find ways of closure, but it's always going to be there. It's just, you know, when I talk to people like Camp Lejeune and different places, Doug, I always remind them, it's okay to look in a rearview mirror driving down the highway, glance at it, see where you've been, try not to make mistakes, do different things, see what's coming behind you. But don't try to focus on a rearview mirror and drive forward. You'll end up in a wreck. You have to keep it in the right perspective. And now I'm talking to myself when I say these things, because there's always a temptation to get locked in on a rearview mirror and sit there for an hour and just lean back and think about it and think about it. But what it tends to do, it shuts me down. It hurts me. I get depressed. I get mad. And so I've learned a rearview mirror is good to look, glance in, But you have to keep your eyes on the horizon if you're going to drive down a road. It'll keep you in the middle of the road, too. And it's a simple thing, a little bit easier than actually doing it. But we have to be reminded of those things. The only difference between me and the people I admire are the choices I make. I need to choose my friends wisely because I'll probably end up like the people I hang around. If you're sitting around a place drinking with a bunch of veterans all day and they're rehashing every bad thing, because the bad things always seem a lot easier to talk about than the good things. But when you're doing that, you are adding a lot of weight onto your own self. The next morning, you don't even feel like getting up going to work. And so you have to be proactive. You have to take care of yourself. And you have to move forward. You have to keep your eyes down the road.
I think the lingering thing from the wall and all those that survived and moved on, because far more did good after Vietnam and came back and they learned the lessons and moved on. The numbers and the contributions of Vietnam veterans is staggering nationwide and in our community. I know it is, and I see that every day. I mean, right here we've got several Vietnam veterans that have focused on our local historical society, putting a whole museum together, incredible work and effort, dedicated effort, taking knowledge, the experience that they've gained through their lifetime to make a big difference.
That's right.
I had a call this morning earlier because we had a story, as you know, we've had the Think Shoot Air Force Base here. We did nuclear bombs, chemical warfare stuff. They had an Army chemical company in Urbana. And back in 1987, the telephone company unearthed chemical munitions that had been buried there intentionally and deliberately.
Wow.
And left. Well, I wrote it up in the guest letter to the editor about it. It came out in the Champaign News Gazette newspaper today. This is on Wednesday. So whatever is today, I've lost track of what the days are even. And
I
lost track of the days. And the individual called and said, I was there, and we complained to the commander when it happened, and we said this was wrong. And I said, thank you for telling me. Now I understand. And it doesn't matter because, you know, what happened happened, and we can't change that. But what we have to do now is go forward and make sure all of it's cleaned up, the medical care is provided to the individuals that were exposed, and that we charge forward. I think for the Vietnam veteran, for myself as a Vietnam Desert Storm veteran and beyond, when the VA decides consciously not to provide you the optimal medical care, or they don't acknowledge what the heck happened to the individual, the injury to the soul is rewounded.
Yeah.
The frustration is brought back to the circle again. And all of us, I mean, it's happened to you personally, it's happened to me, it's happened to Denise, it's happened to everybody. Paul Lyons, God bless him, it reached him again and it hit him again and again and again, and he made the choice where he committed suicide, which is the ultimate end, I guess. I mean, no hope, no dreams or anything, and then everybody else's hopes and dreams that depend on you are gone. But again, it's that choice that you make. And I think that's what that's why the Vietnam Wall and the veterans are so divided and so hurt to this day, because the justification for it and the conscious choice to move forward with forgiveness for yourself has not really happened.
Right. You know, it also goes in every facet of life, too, because I see the same thing in the families. I see wives, I see children, I was at the VA hospital, when was it? Monday, and I was doing a book signing at the VA, and this is one of the largest ones in North Carolina, and the people that were coming up to me, some of them were crying, some of them were reaching out for help. One man told me, his name was Peter, and he was in the Navy, in the Blackwater, you know, craft down south, and he was telling me, he said, I've been dealing with this thing for 45 years, and he said, I've been probably to every kind of VA facility, every kind of therapy, every hospital with post-traumatic stress. I've been to this and that. And he said, I bought your book today because of the title, The Never-Ending War. It never goes away. And I feel like I gave him some solutions that have worked for me that he probably hasn't had before, because the VA is still trying to figure out what is going on and trying to fix it through medications, and they do a lot of great work. But a lot of times, you're dealing with a therapist who's only been doing this thing for 2 years, and they know it only by what they've learned about it, and it's kind of like in a box, and so they don't quite understand why in the world. I had a psychiatrist ask us one time. He said, "I don't get it. Why can't you guys get over this stuff?" And fortunately, they got rid of him within a couple of days of that. But he couldn't understand it. He said, "Why can't you move on?" And because it's in depth. You take a lady that's been molested several times. That woman has a hard time moving through life, just like we did. Her trauma was real. Her combat was real. Her enemy was real. She thought she was losing her life, just like we did. And the brain was producing adrenaline. And then later in life, through a sight, a sound, a smell, that adrenaline began to pump again. And through a memory, the second time, a memory, it goes into a panic attack. All the classic characteristics of adrenaline. If you look up adrenaline on the internet and you were to study it, all the same characteristics of that adrenaline are found in a panic attack. And so that is what is happening. And so they're still catching on to that. They're still finding out what causes the problems. And then you have moral injury. You have a lot of other problems, physical problems. But it's going to take a long time, I guess, to figure it all out, Doug. And in the meantime, here we are. We're living with it. You know, when I was studying up on the wall, it was over 58,000 names, but half of those names were 22 years, were younger than 22 years old or younger when they died. 8 women are on the wall, nurses. It said that 997 were killed on the first day in country. 1,448 died on their very last day in country, on the way home probably. The highest rate of KIAs per capita was West Virginia. The day of the highest casualties was January 31st, 1968, probably the Tet. It's amazing when you get into the inside of what you and I have been talking about this thing called the Vietnam Memorial. It is a place of healing. It's a place of restoration. It is a place where you can draw a line and begin to go to work. Because you're honoring your buddy's lives, and God has more for you to do than sit around and ponder and look in a rearview mirror. There's a lot of work to be done. There's still battles to be fought, Doug. We're fighting them all the time. You're fighting for these Gulf War veterans. And if you get caught and sit down and put your hands in your lap and just sit there, the war's going to go on, but it's not going to be won because you're not fighting it. And so you have to move on.
Look at these kids here, and I'm looking at the enlisted. The E3s. Okay, this is very low grade. 17,995 E3s died. 14,715 E4s died. These are young kids. I mean, we had 525 E1s died. I mean, they haven't even had their diapers changed.
Yep.
You know, so when you look at all this stuff and the casualties and the ages and everything else that happened, then you look back on the families and the families have they moved on after that. What were the hopes and dreams that were shattered? What are the hopes and dreams that are shattered by any war, anything, by the death or when the individual's wounded and can't function? But you know the individual, and I think maybe you and I and all the people we're working with, Denise and everybody else that we've worked with, all the guests that we've had on our show that have tried to give some hint of indication of something that you can do. You make that choice to get an education. You make that choice not to get involved with alcohol or drugs, street drugs. You make the choice to remain active in any endeavor that you choose, whether it be community theater or whether you're gardening in your backyard or whatever you're doing. You make those choices, and anybody and everybody can excel in anything that they choose to do.
That's right. You know, and we do make those choices. But there's some days, Doug, that I can't even hardly get out of bed. There are some days when I don't want to walk any further. I get tired. I get wounded. I get injured. Life is always going around us. And what I have found is that inner strength that will help you when you can't go any further. And they used to say, Ted Turner, I think it was, came up with it, coined the phrase that God is a crutch for weak people. And we found out he's not a crutch for weak people. God is actually a stretcher for the wounded and dying, and he carries us when we can't go any further. And that's the inner strength, the inner peace, the inner joy, and for me, and I think for you too, it's through Jesus Christ. I know there's other religions. I know other people have faults and everything. But he is not only a God to me, he is a friend to me, and he knows me better than my wife does. And she knows about everything about me. And, you know, fortunately, she loves me in spite of everything I am. And God's even better than that. He's always trying to improve me. There was a lesson we had recently. It was on racism. There's a natural thing with people being racist. They don't like other people. And right now, we have wars in the nation. We have blacks against whites. We have the haves against the have-nots. We have just one war after another, Republicans and Democrats and... But God can fix your heart to where you're not racist anymore. He can make you colorblind because you began to care about people more than color or ethnicity or race. And it begins a thing where God began to love through you. Now, that's strong, Doug. I mean, that supersedes any strength that I have, because if it was left up to me, well, we'd all be messed up. But God can fix people, and that's part of the equation with getting healed. Because the VA gives us medication and therapy, and that's great in the right amounts. But what a man and woman truly needs is peace and forgiveness of what has happened in the past. And you can only do that, by going to God and saying, God, have mercy on me and fix me. And God does. And he will help you to move on in spite of your past. And actually, you will turn around and begin to help other people. And I think that behooves all of us to do that kind of thing. The pain is never going to go away. The memories are never going away. But we have to believe there is a point to our sufferings, and that's what he talked about in that book. And so the curing the soul by leading it to finding meaning and purpose, that's pretty heavy. That's one thing the Vietnam veterans weren't told, Doug. That you can actually have a good life and you can have a meaningful life if you will pursue that life.
And that's an individual choice. I mean, in Illinois, every military personnel, anybody enlisted in the military or serves in the Illinois National Guard has free college. So if you went out there and served on active duty for 2 years, you come back and you have at least 4 years of free college.
That is amazing.
And what I learned every time I got reactivated to get over the 35 years that I wore the uniform, you know, from the time I enlisted until I retired, you know, on a PEB date time, it kept reinstating the stuff.
Wow.
So
wow.
You have that opportunity to go. And the GI Bill, I mean, the GI Bill was put in place for our parents, our dads and our uncles and our aunts, whatever, in the military in World War II. And all that stuff put into place, so the educational opportunities are wide open. Granted, we're going to have to make some adaptions and adjustments due to physiological injuries, either affecting, you know, mobility or affecting memory.
Right.
But you can still achieve it, and you can still move on. And so by making that choice to go on and get the education based on what your interests are and goals and what you can achieve, it's there. Now, one of the things that we learned and we had happen with all of us, and especially with Desert Storm, with the reservists, when we got activated for Desert Storm, a lot of us were at the pinnacle of our civilian careers.
Right.
And we got brought back into the war, again, as reservists or National Guard.
Right.
And too many of them came back, and we've had this conversation on the radio show, and Denise is a good example. She's discussed it. The individuals came back with their physiological and psychological injuries, so they had to make a break and a change in career. Well, when you're 19 or 20 or 21, 25, 30 years and younger, your life's in front of you, so you can change your career instantaneously. Just go back and get education and move on. When you're in your 40s or 50s, you get activated. You're at the end of your career, and now all of a sudden, because of your injuries and wounds, you have to make the conscious choice, well, maybe I have to change my career. Well, maybe you do.
Yeah.
But you can take the breath and the knowledge and everything else, the greatness that you've already had, to move on into a new field and achieve greatness even there.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a conscious choice that individuals make. I'm looking at statistics here on the wall, another thing, and this is one thing that's been said over and over and over again, is that the blacks, African Americans, suffered far more than the whites, you know, and put in the situation. Well, I'm looking at the number of casualties and deaths by race, the number of a total enlisted an officer was 42,517 whites and 7,117 African Americans. Now, it doesn't justify it at all.
No,
racial than anything, but it again is one of those fallacies that have been put out that, well, this was who the war was about and whatever thing they were put into the thing, and far, far more casualties, when in reality it wasn't. So there's this psychological impediment, you know, based on misinformation that's created a problem.
It has. You know, in the jungles, we lived in the jungles most of the time. And out there, I heard a man say later in life, he said, you know, we might have all come to this land in different types of ships, but now we're all in the same boat. And when you're out there in combat, you're not looking at the guy's color next to you to see, you know, look at him. You're not looking at his color. You're just making sure everybody's shooting in the right direction. And out there, there was no, I never saw any kind of racism or prejudice or anything like that. Now, you might get back to a place where they give a few beers or something. You might hear something. Usually blacks hanging out with blacks, and whites hung out with whites or whatever. That's just a natural, normal thing that people do sometimes. But I didn't see a lot of racism where I was at, because we were all soldiers. We were all Marines. We were all airmen. We had a job to do. And you had to understand the enemy's not in the camp. The enemy is on the outside, and we had a common enemy. So it is a myth many times, because there was a lot of young white faces over there that were suffering just as much as anybody else. This war was a war where we took a lot of young casualties. I think the average age was 19 years old. So, and I've read that before. In World War II, I think it was like 23, I think it was. And there's a big difference because of just the maturity factor. These young men were having their lives changed very early in life in a lot of different ways, and they were coming home changed. And they also, when they came home, they walked into the sexual, sexual revolution. They walked into the drug-infested world, and it was really changing while they were gone. They came into a world that didn't understand where they had been. A lot of their peers had moved on in life, and now they're working for them. You know, and so a lot of the great girls were taken already. So we had to go back and take the secondary jobs and the kind of leftovers. That's a joke. Nobody's laughing, but that's a joke. That was among, you know, veterans. But life had changed without us. And we came back and we felt a lot of bad emotions and trying to fit back into a world that we really didn't fit into very well. And so
when I got to college,
Doug, you had to just keep secret about a lot of things.
When I got
you
to college, I mean,
share
I got out
your
on,
former life in the Air Force.
When I got out on Tuesday and started college on Friday, and I wasn't a human being, you know, and yeah, granted, I was 22 years old when I started college as a freshman. And I was lucky I had an incredible group that I got experience with. There was a conscious choice of who I was going to hang out with.
Right.
And because of the veterans and everything else, interests, I ended up hanging out with the local police officers who were all veterans. And so we made the conscious choice in who we were going to work with. And so, yeah, we did drinking, but we didn't go drinking. And you were out there consciously working to improve yourself all the time, working in the community to improve the community. And everybody can achieve that. Every single person can do that. Every person can achieve greatness within their own realm by just making that choice. as you said in what we hear today, and you've talked about it over and over again, and I've seen it over and over again, the new kids, they went in the military with problems. They got into more problems in the military. They got sick, wounded, and injured, and the casualty numbers are far greater for DNVI than everything ever imagined today. And then they came back, and they had all these problems, and now they don't know how to deal with it.
No.
And as you said over and over again, they feel like they're lost. They're behind a wall. How do they get out from behind this wall? Well, that's a conscious choice that they're going to move on. And I think, for me, that's what the wall represents. We lost all of these.
Yeah.
But yet it's still pointing towards another great future for all of those that remain.
Yeah. The amazing thing about the wall, when you look at the wall, the names, you reflect your faith back at you. You do get a chance to look at you. One of the problems I had, Doug, and when I came back home, I wasn't wounded. I was never physically wounded. Now, I had some bullet holes in my helmet. I had some shrapnel in my flak jacket. Very close calls many times, but I never was physically wounded. So I eliminated myself from the VA. I didn't go to the VA. I didn't want anything they had to do with it. I went one time when because I came home. I was broken up, and I came home, and so I had to go to be checked out by the VA. And I had a bad experience. I almost felt like I was a second-class citizen, like I was being run to a cattle farm. And when I came out of that, I said, never again. I'm done. And so I never went back for 32 years. I suffered myself. Had I known about college opportunities, had I known about some of the benefits, I may have taken advantage of those things. But there's a lot of people today that are caught up in this thing of saying, if I'm in the military, that if I say something, I'm going to get thrown out of the military. I'm going to ruin my record. I'm going to ruin my career. So I'll just be quiet. And they're self-medicating themselves with drugs and alcohol and things, and they're trying to quietly live while the flames are raging inside of them. And sometimes it will boil out. But other ones, they say, well, I don't have money to be fixed. Some of these young people that are dealing with trauma and post-trauma, they don't know what to do. Well, the thing about it is, and the program that I work with and the program you work with and the program that we're reading about today and then Dr. Shaw, I'm sorry that phone rang, but the programs that we deal with are things that work, Doug. It's not putting Band-Aids on people. It is actually motivating them to get yourself up, stand up, wash yourself off, comb your hair, and start moving forward. Find you a goal, move forward, and you can have a great life if you will do it in spite of your injuries. You'll still have to deal with them. But you're able to progress and have a good life. And you've proven that, Doug. And I'm trying to prove it to these young men, women, that
every
we didn't live through this thing. We are actually victims who've survived, and not only survived, but we also thrived. I have a good life.
Can adapt
and I'm glad
your life.
But it didn't happen by accident. And it will not happen by accident with these young warriors. They're going to have to move forward. These young women that have been molested in growing up, the young men been molested, they're having those injuries for the rest of their life. What they have to understand is you got to move on regardless. And they say, well, I don't have money to do certain things. There's a lot of programs, if you will look hard for those programs. And once you begin to open the door and walk in and talk to people, they will actually guide you into where you need to go. But you have to make the first step of humbling yourself enough to say, I'm injured, I'm depressed, I'm hurt, and I'm tired of hurting. Where do I go to get help? And that's how they can do it.
Perseverance, I think, is a key to anything. If you persevere, you're going to overachieve. You can achieve anything and do greatness. I mean, completing school is nothing but perseverance because everybody is capable. It's just a matter of how much effort and how much help do you ask for and do you accept. And then how do you modify and adapt? I mean, I'd love to get on my motorcycle again. I got my first motorcycle on my 16th birthday in 1965. And because of my combat injuries, I had to dismantle that motorcycle. I still have it. I had to dismantle it. The doctor said, if you get on it and get driving and fall over, we ain't fixing you again. You know, so that loss is great. But when then that loss happened, another thing opened up. So, okay, I'll go get myself a three-wheel bicycle. Yeah, I can't go down the road on a two-wheeler anymore because the balance is gone.
Yeah.
But I can still go down the road.
That's right.
I just get a three-wheeler.
And that's good therapy, too. The wind in your face is good therapy.
You know, it's just...
You know, I ride a Harley, and it's a big Harley, and kind of a sporter type of bike. It's a Heritage Softail, and it's chromed out, and it's very loud and all this stuff. But a lot of times, you just lean back and take a ride. It's like sitting in a lounge chair or recliner watching the world go by. And it's a good, relaxing. It actually causes you to pump adrenaline a little bit. And that adrenaline pump is good, too, because there's a purpose in having that. And so you find coping skills. You find my wife would see that I'm having a bad morning or something, and she'd say, why don't you take a ride? And so she would recognize it. And so I'd get on my bike, and I'd ride for couple hours, and I come back, and I'd be more set to begin to do what I had to do. I had responsibilities. I had a job. So you're going to be dealing with it. What you have to do is learn coping mechanisms. You have to find out what the problem is and how to avoid it sometimes, and the triggers that cause your brain to produce adrenaline that causes panic attacks. If you go on my website, the www.theneverendingwar.com, and it's Unseen Scars of Post-Traumatic Stress. If you go on there, if someone goes on there, there's a lot of information they can get. And they don't have to pay a professional psychiatrist, someone to give it to them. They can actually get it free. And not only my website, but there's a lot of other ones. And they can find a lot of coping skills, Doug, that we've proven work for us. And without all the medications of alcohol and drugs and pharmacy, and these things do work. Look, I want to say one thing before we get off the air, but I was thinking about the Moore injury, and I was talking about the energy that keeps me moving from day to day. Solomon was the richest man ever lived. He was the wisest man ever lived. God endowed him with great wisdom, but after an entire life, he had his ups and downs and bads and good, but he concluded this, and it said it in Ecclesiastes 9, I think it is. No, Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13, 14. He said, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. God shall bring every work into judgment and every secret thing, whether it be good or evil. We have to try to shun the evil and try to promote the good.
Well, we're at the end of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Vietnam Wall is at Lake of the Woods Forest Preserve for the next 4 days in Mahomet, Illinois. If you get an opportunity in the Midwest, come visit it. Get the healing that takes place at the wall. God bless America. Thank you, evening. Good night. Thank you, Ray.